The Thomistic Institute's Aquinas 101 program is bringing the truth of the Catholic faith to millions every year, but it's only possible because of support from listeners like you. Aquinas 101 is entirely audience-funded. Each episode exists thanks to your generosity. Will you help make the next one possible with a small gift? Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/donate to learn more. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/donate.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
But so this topic really is the positive corollary of the privation theory of evil. If we accept that evil is not a real entity, but a lack of goodness where goodness should be, then you might think that it simply follows that everything that exists is good insofar as it exists. It doesn't actually quite follow, but it's a view that's naturally at home with the privation theory of evil. After all, you could think, well, suppose that things in themselves are neutral, or that aspects of being were totally value neutral, and then you could still define evil as a lack of goodness without it entailing that every being, just insofar as it exists, is good. So it's a corollary, I'm calling it, but not an entailment of the privation theory of evil, that everything that exists is good insofar as it exists. And so this, too, is a view that is well represented in the great theologians of the church, in particular the patristic and scholastic era. I promised a kind of genealogy, intellectual history of why this way of thinking is no longer intuitive to us or as widespread as I think it ought to be. And I forgot to do that in the first talk, and I think I'll open here by saying a little bit about that. As you will know already from the privation talk, the way that we think of evil as a lack of goodness where goodness should be includes thinking of things as having natures. It's because there is, by nature, some way a thing ought, in some sense of ought, to be, that we're able to make judgments like there is some goodness missing here that ought to be here. And it's that idea that we have natures with essential properties, with an ingrained teleology. And once you lose that sort of picture of the world, then the privation theory of evil and the convertibility of being in goodness become less intuitive. So you might think that if you find yourself at all attracted to the picture about value represented by these two talks, you might need to continue to dig down and examine or re-examine the broadly Thomistic and Aristotelian idea that the world is divided into things that have essences, and that these essences have natural ends. Insofar as Western intellectual history moved away from that kind of essentialist and teleological understanding of the world in the early modern era and to our own day, then the privation theory of evil and the transcendentality of goodness just became less and less sensible or plausible. But as many thinkers have pointed out, there is no fundamental obstacle to the Thomistic or Aristotelian who wants to take modern science seriously. We don't have to be reductionistic in our understanding of the physical world, or anti-essentialist in our understanding of the physical world, in order to learn from the great advances of the physical sciences. So insofar as we're able to recapture a teleological understanding of nature, we make more and more room for an understanding of evil as privation and an understanding of all creatures as intrinsically good. So when we talk about the convertibility of being and goodness, I think it's helpful to recognize something that came up earlier in the Q&A, that the goodness of things that we're considering here is the sort of goodness that can, at least in principle, come in degrees. So from the example earlier, a bee is good, but has less goodness than a human being, for example. So some kinds of things are better than other kinds of things. But another way in which goodness can come in degrees is among individuals of the same species. So we talk about a good dog versus a bad dog. The good dog is better than the bad dog. So even though they share the same nature, there are, in the better specimen, there is a more full actualization of the potentialities given to that thing by its nature than there is in the worse specimen. So it's better than the other. So before we sort of get into the how of this, why should we be interested in thinking this way if we can pull it off, so to speak? And I think here we have more or less the same reason as in the privation talk, that we start here with the doctrine of creation, recognizing that God, who is the good, expresses himself in the created world. And so that we should expect everything that God makes insofar as it is an expression of himself, if in no other way, to be good, or at least to reflect the divine goodness in some way. So I want to consider two ways in which we can think of the convertibility of being in goodness. And I'm dividing these up in a rather Thomistic way, since this is a Thomistic Institute retreat. Aquinas doesn't do it quite this way, though the content is all in St. Thomas. It's just the organization here is a little bit different from the way he does it. I want to look at the way in which the natures of things give us an insight into the goodness of all things. And then I want to look at the way in which just sheer existence, irrespective of nature, gives us an insight into the goodness of all things. So nature first. So start with our familiar point that everything that exists has a nature. This is, to me, a very exciting claim. I mean, there is no such thing as just a bare thing. Things come in kinds. There are oak trees and stars and people, water, and so on. Occasionally, we're in a position where we're just ignorant of the nature of a thing. And so there are times when we might only be able to recognize it as a thing. You know, imagine the example I think comes from Avicenna. You're looking from a great distance and you see, a blob on the horizon. And you say, well, and it's shadowed or whatever. What's that thing over there? You know there's a thing. And you could even know that that thing must have a nature, but you know so little about it that all you can do is identify it as a thing. But that has to do with, obviously, our ways of knowing, our ways of perceiving. In themselves, things always come in kinds. Things have natures. Now, second, and this is on the handout, you can follow these points under the how, two ways, nature, and then these 5 points I'd like to make. And consider also that to have a nature is for there to be some kinds of distinctive features or characteristic activities. Sometimes people might say essential properties. That is from a broadly Aristotelian perspective, kind of a vulgar way to put it, because in contemporary, at least analytic philosophy parlance, essential property often means something like necessary property, and that's not really what we mean. For example, it is essential to a human being to be two-legged. But of course, someone who loses his legs, or someone who is born without legs, is no less a human being. It's just that the human form is to be two-legged. And if someone lacks one or more legs, we suppose that something has gone wrong, either congenitally or through trauma later in life. So essential, part of the essence, but not necessary. And that's a very important distinction. So we have so instead of essential properties, I'm using this formula, distinctive features and characteristic activities. Now, suppose you have some shiny yellow piece of metal, and you're wondering whether it is gold or pyrite. Gold is smooth and easy to scratch. Pyrite is crystalline and scratch resistant. So these characteristics are what help us identify something as gold and not pyrite, precisely because one set of characteristics is distinctive of the type, gold, the nature, gold, and the other set of the other nature. Medical students learn about human health and sickness and disease and injury by studying a few examples, the pictures in the textbook or the cadavers in the lab. And the presumption is that in these few examples, the student gains an expertise about human health in general and not just what's wrong or right about these particular examples. You know, in the case of the cadavers, I mean, I guess a lot is wrong, but you get the idea. We're supposed to be able to make generalizable inferences about the species, all the members of the species, from the particular example. This is an obvious point in one way, but it's the less obvious is that in studying the particulars, we are learning the kind. We're learning about the nature itself, so that whenever we identify something with that nature, we have a way of predicting what will be true of that individual. So, of course, in medical practice, future doctors will come up against cases that medical school hasn't prepared them for. But the unusual or rare cases attest both to the incompleteness of medical knowledge and the great diversity among individual human beings. But again, despite the diversity, there's this great unity. And without that unity, it wouldn't make sense for there to be a study and practice of medicine. We'd have to invent a new discipline each time a new patient came in, but we don't do that. Okay, so third, once we've recognized that things come in natures and that to have a nature is for there to be some distinctive features or characteristic activities that one engages in, insofar as one is a member of that kind. Third, we observe that a thing's nature then serves as a sort of standard or measure against which an individual of that nature may be evaluated. For example, we have good reason to think that something is wrong with a person whose temperature is 104 degrees because the normal or ideal temperature of a human being is 98.6. If the oak tree's leaves are whitish or look rusty, we know something is wrong with the tree. And the arborist's efforts to help the tree are precisely efforts to do for the tree what it needs in order for it to align with its type. Now, there are some kinds of things that don't seem to be susceptible of departing from the norms set by their natures. I think this is pretty interesting. You know, like there can't be a defective piece of gold, for example. To be gold, you know, maybe not a big enough piece, right? Maybe really hard to extract. But as gold, you can't be defective gold. You know, fool's gold is not gold. But other things, paradigmatically living things, right? Something can go wrong with them in a way that nothing can go wrong with gold, except for unless it's simply destroyed. I think maybe an electron can't be a defective electron, but I don't know enough to know if that's true or not. But this point about some types of things having individuals that can't be defective members of their kind, that's not the main point. The main point is that we judge how well or badly a thing is doing by how it measures up to its kind. And so when a thing is good or bad, when we judge a thing is good or bad, and we're correct in our judgment, the grounds of the judgment is the nature, is the standards set by a thing's nature. Okay, so then I think one thing that's helpful here is to reflect on the conceptual connection between goodness and perfection. You know, perfection, depending on how we're thinking about it, sometimes we mean something like really, really, really good or nothing wrong with it. But there's also a sense of perfection that means completeness. Not just nothing wrong, but nothing lacking. To be as good as one can be is maybe a physical impossibility for most individual things, but to be as good as one can be is to, so to speak, max out one's own nature, to be perfect within a nature. And then if that's true, then anything, if you are not fully maxing out your nature in any way whatsoever, there is a technical sense in which you are imperfect. So the perfect considered in an ideal sense, the perfect would be that which has all potentialities intrinsic to its nature, fully actualized and so on. Again, maybe a physical impossibility in our current state. One is perfect, complete in one's nature. So then imperfection simply follows as a consequence. No matter how good you are, that little bit of lack entails that you are imperfect. Now, in ordinary ways of speaking, we don't think that something with that is a really excellent specimen, but still technically imperfect, we wouldn't say that such a thing is bad. Right? But this ordinary way of talking is a little bit arbitrary and it's a little bit context sensitive, right? So, you know, if you had a lion that was a magnificent lion and had one missing tooth, you'd think, well, still an excellent lion. It's not a bad lion, even though technically speaking, the missing tooth is an imperfection in the lion. And it's an imperfection precisely because it's the sort of thing that the lion essence or nature specifies lions to have. I don't know how many teeth, but go with the example. Okay, so goodness, or perfection is perfect goodness within a kind is this full realization or maxing out of nature. Everything below that, even very excellent specimens, are imperfect. So putting this all together, if everything has a nature, everything measures up to its nature in some way. The good things measure up pretty well. The bad things don't measure up very well. There's a lot lacking, a lot of imperfection. But there's for anything that has a nature, there's going to be some degree of goodness within that nature that it has at any particular moment of its existence. And if the nature that it has specifies certain kinds of norms that are the grounds for our judgments about how well or badly things are doing, well, then the nature of a thing really does provide a way of seeing how everything is good. Good insofar as it is meeting some of the norms of its nature. So call that the convertibility of being in goodness with respect to natures or essences. And now let's consider the convertibility of being in goodness with respect to existence. And this one, I think, is maybe a little more abstract. But still worth doing. Okay, so Aquinas famously distinguishes essence and existence. If we consider the essence or nature of any creatable kind of thing, we can identify, let's say, or define its essential features, and in no creatable nature will existence itself be included in that nature. There's only one essence that has existence as its quasi-defining feature, and that's the divine essence. The divine essence is identical with its existence. Every other essence there does not include existence, so that if anything exists that has that nature, we can in some sense distinguish its existence from its nature. Now, so what I want us to ask is, we think about this distinction between essence and existence. We've already seen how having a nature, it, all on its own, entails that everything that exists that has a nature has at least a little bit of goodness. So now, can we think of existence itself as being good, irrespective of nature? And I think we can. So here we have some Aquinas to read. And this comes from, it's a little bit more Boethius, actually, but through the back door. So Boethius has this very mysteriously named small book called the De Hebdomadibus. And no one really knows why it's called that. And Aquinas was so interested in this that he wrote a commentary on it. He wrote a lot of commentaries, but not on, for all of the authors that he knew really well, and all of the works by these authors that he cites in his various works, a rather small proportion of those actually get their own commentary And Aquinas commented on two works of Boethius. So that shows that Aquinas suggests Aquinas held him in high regard. I will spare you the details of this book as a whole, but I'll just say that the topic of Boethius's book, De Hebdomadibus, is whether all creatures are good and in what way are they good. And he raises a couple puzzles about this and tries to suggest that indeed all creatures are good and that their goodness in some way or other comes from God. And when Aquinas comments on this conclusion of the De Hebdomadibus, he amplifies Boethius's claim in a way that, to me at least, is very helpful. Whether it accurately represents Boethius's own reasoning is a different issue. There's a book by wonderful Thomistic scholar who died about 10 years ago, Ralph McInerney, on the connection between Boethius and Aquinas. It's a fine book. And McInerney at least thinks that Aquinas got Boethius right. But that's not our focus here. Aquinas, summing up his understanding of Boethius, says this, that there is a twofold goodness in creatures, a twofold goodness. One, inasmuch as they are creatures, are termed good through a relation to the first good, God. According to this, both their being and whatever is in them from the first good is good. The other goodness is considered in them absolutely, inasmuch, namely, as each one is termed good insofar as it is complete in being and in operating. And this completion does not belong to created goods according to their essential to be itself. This is not my translation. But according to something superadded called their virtue. Now that is murky. So if that was hard to understand, you were reading it well. This distinction here, the goodness that comes directly from having been created by God, and then this second goodness that is not according to its essa essentiale, but according to something superadded. Right? Now, I was puzzling over this, and it occurred to me that Aquinas has this distinction of goodness elsewhere in his writing, and I've decided, you can feel free to contradict the interpretation of Aquinas, but I think it's a good view. In his questions on goodness in the first part of the Summa, he distinguishes what he calls one goodness and many goodnesses, and says that everything that exists is good simply by coming from the one good and sharing in its existence in a participatory way. But there's also a goodness that things have that belongs to them formally speaking, that is according to the intrinsic nature that a thing has. So Aquinas at least is suggesting, influenced by Boethius, that there is this twofold way in which things are good. God gives existence to creatures, and in giving existence, gives something that is good. Can't give anything else. But he also, in giving existence to creatures, causes individuals with certain natures to exist. And once we have natures on the scene, then we can describe a second way in which things are good. So we have kind or nature relative goodness, and then we have just absolute goodness in creatures. And there is a really profound way in which these two sorts of goodnesses are unified. And that is that the natures of things are not just abstract intelligibles in some kind of Platonic sense, you know, that the nature of the giraffe is some sort of necessarily existing form that God somehow sees as an option. Like, oh, there are giraffe nature out there, so I can, that's one of the things that is eligible to be made. No, Aquinas instead sees it like this. Where does the very possibility of the giraffe, the human or whatever kind of thing, where does it come from? Not an abstract Platonic realm. From God's own self-knowledge. And this is the famous doctrine of the divine ideas. That instead of Platonic forms, God thinks himself perfectly. And in thinking himself, thinks of all of the infinitely many ways in which he is imitable. So you can imagine God having an idea that includes infinitely many little copies of himself. And Aquinas says that to be a creaturely essence is to be one of these ways in which God thinks of himself as imitable. And so then when God sets out to actually make things, not only is the existence itself that creatures are given a kind of reflection of the subsistent existence that God himself is, but there's a second way that because God makes things that have natures, and because all of these natures are God's own limited self-understandings of himself as imitable, then each giraffe, each human being, each lion, and so on, is a little copy of the divine essence. So God is the archetype or exemplar of all creaturely existence and all creaturely essences. And so when we think about the convertibility of being in goodness, it's not merely that that everything is good, as though, I mean, that's good enough. That's pretty nice. But that the goodness of things, both in their existence and in their natures, have this relation to God. So there is a real sense in which, in coming to know any aspect of the created world, we are getting in touch with something divine. Not divine only in its efficient causal origin, but divine because of its relationship to its exemplar, its divine exemplar. And that, so we talked last time in the privation talk about the hopefulness of the privation theory of evil. And here I want to highlight the hopefulness of the convertibility of being in goodness, but also something like the joy of it, a kind of a way in which it can focus the attention on the goodness of things rather than on the badness of things. Even the goodness of ordinary things or things that we think of as, you know, merely neutral, neither good nor bad. No, according to St. Thomas and his tradition, everything is good in this double way. I think that's a pretty good view. All right, that's it. Let's go to Q&A.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.